5. We left the town in the rearview mirror and followed the highway for another mile or so. We were back in the woods, driving under a dense canopy of trees that blocked out the sun. Then the GPS ordered a sharp right turn onto a narrow single-lane road. It didn't have a name or a sign or anything to suggest we were traveling in the correct direction, but the computer insisted we were, and told me to follow unknown route for 0.7 miles. I said, "This feels wrong," but Tammy encouraged me to keep going. We descended a long sloping hill, hurtling deeper and deeper into the wilderness. The asphalt was mottled with cracks and divots and sinkholes. All the bumps were doing a real number on my suspension, and I pumped the brakes, slowing my speed to 20 miles an hour. There was a giant rock in the middle of the lane, about the size of a basketball, just waiting to destroy my front axle. I swerved to avoid it, and one of my tires nearly sank into a crater. "We're going the wrong way," I said. "The gardeners would never live on a road like this."
"Let me tell you something about rich people," Tammy explained. "They're not all like Elvis Presley, buying mansions right in town so everyone can gape at them. Real rich people hide their money. They don't want you to know how much there is, and they definitely don't want you looking at it. So you have to work really hard to find their houses. Trust me, I watch a lot of HGTV.
The trip computer was counting down the distance to our destination. 800 feet, 600 feet, 400 feet, and still no houses or buildings in sight. Just dark, dank forest, stretching as far as I could see. I slowed to a stop and the computer said,
"You have arrived at your destination."
Which made me laugh, because we were very clearly lost. "I told you so, Tammy. I knew we should have turned around. Now we're going to be late for lunch." I cut the wheel to make a K-turn, and Abigail tapped on her window.
"Over there," she said. "Do you see?"
God, it was so easy to miss. A small break in the pines, and a narrow strip of gravel, winding even deeper into the woods. It might have been the access road for a utility company, except for the bouquet of gold balloons, the only clue we were still on the right track.
"Bingo!" Tammy said. "Great eye, Abigail."
The gravel driveway was even more rutted and ragged than the road we'd left behind. The trees and bushes were overgrown, and bright green leaves smeared against our windows as we drove along. But every so often there was another cluster of gold balloons, encouraging us to keep going. I wondered how anyone navigated this driveway in the winter, when it was likely buried under layers of snow and ice. And then the road widened, the trees fell away, and we found ourselves crossing a large grassy meadow about the size of a soccer field. There were rows and rows of solar panels on both sides of the road, shiny black rectangles angled toward the sky, and at the far end of the meadow, we arrived at a small wooden hut with a lowered gate, like something you'd see at the entrance of a state park. A tall, large man with a bushy gray beard stepped out of the hut, holding a tablet computer and waving us forward. He was my age, more or less, and wore a blue mariner's cap and a cream cable-knit sweater, like he'd just returned from a voyage at sea.
"Welcome to Osprey Cove, Mr. Zatowski."
I had to laugh. It was like Aiden's apartment all over again. "How do you know my name?"
"It's my job, sir. I am Hugo, and I am the property manager."
He had a curious sing-song accent that rose and fell with every syllable. Swedish? Swiss? I had no idea.
"Did everyone have a nice trip?"
"It was fine," I said.
"Oh, Hugo, it was wonderful,"
Tammy exclaimed, leaning across my lap and shouting to make herself heard.
"What a glorious morning."
"I am happy to hear that, Ms. Zatowski."
He wore a small radio in his right ear. A hearing aid, I supposed, or maybe some kind of communication device. Hugo reached inside the vehicle and stuck a small square of blue paper to the windshield.
This is your parking permit. If you could leave this up, you'll help us tremendously.
We need a parking permit?
So we know you're a member of the family. We have a lot of guests coming, and a lot of cars to park.
There were two other men still inside the hut, trim, muscular guys in black shirts and pants. One had a Semper Fi tattoo on his forearm, but even without it, I would have flagged him as ex-military. There's a certain look you get when you come of age in the service, and for the guys who roll right into law enforcement or private security, that look never really goes away. Meanwhile, Hugo was continuing his welcome to Osprey Cove speech.
Now, has anyone told you about the time difference? You'll need to move your watches forward by 15 minutes. We call it Gardner Standard Time, because Errol Gardner likes to run 15 minutes ahead of the competition.
I thought he was kidding, but he showed me his wristwatch, and sure enough, the time was set to 12:53.
It's painless, I promise. You'll adjust right away. And the best part is, no jet lag.
Tammy couldn't wait to get started. She asked how to override the clock on her iPhone, and Hugo was happy to walk around to her side of the car and give her a tutorial. Then he extended his hand, offering to fix my phone as well.
I'll leave mine alone, I told him.
Hugo warned that I was making a mistake.
A lot of people try that approach, to add the minutes mentally. But sooner or later, everyone forgets. And you don't want to be late for Margaret's wedding?
I won't be late, I assured him. I guarantee that's not going to happen. Abigail leaned forward from the back seat, wriggling between me and Tammy. She wore a cheap Minnie Mouse wristwatch that looked like it came from a gumball machine.
Can someone fix mine?
You don't have to, I told her, if you don't want to.
I do want to,
she said.
Of course you want to, Tammy said. You want to fit in this weekend and feel like part of the family.
She adjusted the tiny dial on Abigail's watch, advancing the minute hand forward.
Mr. Frank wants to stay stuck in the past.
It's called Eastern Standard Time, I pointed out. I'm pretty sure the president uses it.
But we're not at the White House. We're at Maggie's wedding, and you need to quit being a party pooper.
Fair enough. I wore a digital Timex watch that Colleen gave me for our fifth wedding anniversary, and I futzed with its buttons until the clock read 12:53.
Is everyone happy now? It's going to be a wonderful weekend,
Hugo promised. And then he passed me a paper map illustrating the entire lakefront property with all its cottages and amenities.
Now, Margaret and Aiden are waiting for you at Osprey Lodge, straight down this road, all the way at the end. But before you go, I still need to grab your privacy docs.
Privacy what?
Just a simple waiver saying any privileged information you find on the property is treated confidentially. So you won't, you know, steal Mr. Gardner's secrets and start your own battery company.
Hugo grinned at his own joke, then passed his iPad through my open window.
Just sign in the box with your finger.
We're here for the wedding, I said.
I understand, Mr. Zatowski. It is totally pro forma. Everybody signs a privacy doc.
I looked down at the iPad and a dense thicket of legal jargon. Page 1 of 56, like the user agreements for wireless phone carriers and health insurance policies. I scrolled through the text and found all of it incomprehensible. The non-disclosure provisions of this agreement shall survive the termination of this agreement and Mr. Frank Zatowski's duty to hold confidential information in confidence shall remain in effect in perpetuity or until Fountainhead 7 LLC sends Mr. Frank Zatowski written notice releasing Mr. Frank Zatowski from this agreement, whichever occurs first. "What's Fountainhead 7? I asked.
"Oh, for crying out loud, give me the iPad,"
Tammy said, yanking the device from my hands and slashing at the screen with her finger.
"Does Abigail need to sign too? My foster daughter?"
"No, just adults," Hucho said.
"And can I sign my brother's name for him? Just to speed things along. We're late for lunch."
"I'm very sorry. He needs to do it himself."
"I'd just like to know what I'm signing," I told them. When I was a kid, my father told me I should never sign my name to a document that I didn't understand. But these days, it was impossible to live by that rule. You couldn't get cable TV or even a discount card at the supermarket without agreeing to thousands of terms and conditions. "I've never been to a wedding with a, what do you call this again?"
"Privacy document, sir," Hucho said.
"Why is it 56 pages?
"I don't know, sir. To be honest, I don't think anyone's ever read it."
In the rearview mirror, I glimpsed a silver Tesla slowing to a stop behind me. I ignored the new arrival and concentrated on the screen. "The parties agree that any breach or threatened breach of this agreement by Mr. Frank Zatowski entitles Fountainhead 7 LLC and or members of the Gardner family to seek injunctive relief, in addition to any other legal or equitable remedies available to it in any court of competent jurisdiction." And what the hell did any of this actually mean? It was hard to concentrate with Tammy shrieking in my ear. She was already on the phone with Maggie, calling to complain.
"Yes, sweetie, we just got here. We're at the little toll booth thingy. But the problem is your father. He's being an absolute mule about this privacy doc. No, privacy doc. On the iPad."
"Exactly.
I know, I know. That's what I said. But you talk to him. He'll listen to you."
She smacked the phone against my ear.
"Dad, it's totally fine," Maggie said.
"I'm just skimming it. If your aunt would shut up for 2 minutes, maybe I could finish."
"Please don't make a big deal about this. It doesn't even apply to you."
"Then why do I have to sign it?"
"Everyone signs it. They won't let you pass unless you sign it."
"Maggie, I'm your father. Are you telling me that Errol Gardner won't let me attend my own daughter's wedding if I don't sign this contract?"
"It's not a contract."
"It's 56 pages written by lawyers, and no one can tell me what it means. I just want to ask someone."
"Seriously? Is this really how you want to start this weekend? By having a conversation with the capacity legal team? Can you please just do this the normal way? Please?"
In my rearview mirror, I glimpsed a black Audi pulling up behind the Tesla. Hucho addressed both cars with a small, apologetic wave, a quiet plea for a little more patience. I tried to read as quickly as I could. "This agreement is binding on me, my heirs, executors, administrators, and assigns and inures to the benefit of the company, its successors, and assignees." But it was only page 4 of 56, and I realized I would never get through it all. So I just scribbled my signature and ticked a box marked, "I accept." Tammy sighed with relief and told Maggie we were good.
"It's finished, sweetie. We'll see you in a minute."
Hucho took back the iPad, ensured that we'd done everything correctly, and smiled.
"Very good, sir. Now just proceed straight down this road. We call it Main Street. You'll pass a few smaller cottages, but keep going to the big one."
"How will I know it's the big one?"
"I think you'll know. Enjoy the wedding."
The gate went up and I drove away without thanking him, which my sister interpreted as a slight.
You don't have to be rude, Frankie. He was just doing his job.
We shouldn't have signed it. You have no idea what we just agreed to.
Maggie says it doesn't apply to us.
So why did we sign? She threw up her hands, the universal gesture for, I don't want to talk about this anymore. As we drove along, I glimpsed two more guards dressed in black. They were deep in the woods and walking along what appeared to be a 10-foot-high metal fence. It looked like something from Jurassic Park, designed to keep the dinosaurs from getting out. I could only glimpse a small section, but it seemed to wind through the woods in both directions. Meanwhile, Tammy opened the map to take a closer look. It was the sort of cartoony drawing you'd get at an amusement park. All the buildings had numbers, and there was a legend at the bottom to help you identify them. Five cottages had lakefront views, and another nine were farther inland, plus a game room, a spa, wellness center, a boathouse, and a few smaller buildings marked staff. Each structure was named after a different bird, from tiny one-bedroom bungalows like hummingbird and warbler to larger two-story buildings like falcon, bald eagle, and ibis. Tammy read aloud from a history on the back side of the map.
In 1953, the Lutheran Church purchased 300 acres of land on Lake Windham to create Osprey Cove, a Christian overnight camp that operated for more than 30 years before falling on hard times and closing in 1988. The camp lay dormant for more than a decade until its purchase by Errol Gardner in 1999. Together with his wife, Catherine, and son, Aiden, he reimagined Osprey Cove as a sanctuary for the world's most innovative thinkers, leaders, artists, and entrepreneurs. We invite you to follow a good idea along our 6 miles of walking trails, or relax and recharge in our spacious, well-appointed cottages, and paddle toward future inspiration on the shores of Lake Windham. Oh, Abigail! Doesn't this sound incredible?
The kid had her hands and face pressed against the window, watching in fascination as the first few buildings came into view. The gardeners must have demolished the original cabins, because all these log and timber cottages looked contemporary, with big picture windows and lots of expensive hand-finished construction details. Next to the front door of each residence was a wooden sign illustrating its namesake, Kingfisher, Loon, Woodpecker, Puffin.
Which house is theirs? Abigail asked.
All of them, Tammy said. They own everything you're looking at, and all these people work for them.
Everywhere we looked, employees were washing windows, shaking out rugs, pruning branches, painting fences, and sweeping dry leaves from porches. We passed a woman in a blue housekeeping dress, pushing a wheeled basket piled high with white linen sheets. And then three sweat-soaked men kneeling at the side of the road, laying down mulch in a flower bed. They were all dressed in matching green polos and light khaki pants.
Oh, for crying out loud, I said.
What's wrong?
Look at them, and then look at me.
Tammy realized that I was dressed in a green polo and light khaki pants, too.
Well, I'm sure they could use a hand, Frankie. Maybe you want to pull over.
Abigail laughed so hard she sneezed, spraying a fine wet mist all over my window. But before I could complain about it, Main Street curved around a bend, and Osprey Lodge came into view. Its design reminded me of the Old Faithful Inn at Yellowstone National Park. It was a three-story fortress of timber and glass and quarry stone, with wide balconies and long banisters, handcrafted from lengths of gnarled wood. The road ended in a roundabout at the entrance to the lodge, and as we slowed to a stop, I saw Aiden reaching for my daughter's hand. Maggie was dressed like a camp counselor in a pink t-shirt, khaki shorts, and tiny Converse sneakers, and she hugged me as soon as I got out of the Jeep.
I'm so glad you're here, she said.
We're going to have so much fun this weekend.
Aiden wore a long-sleeved sweatshirt and baggy pants, spotted with little flecks of paint. I said it looked like he'd been hard at work, and he smiled but didn't elaborate. The wedding wasn't until Saturday, but already he seemed nervous, on edge.
What a place! Tammy exclaimed. It's like the Garden of Eden.
She breathed deeply, filling her lungs with the intoxicating scent of fresh pine.
We don't have air like this back home. It's all so clean.
Abigail was still in the back of the Jeep, clearly not sure how she fit into the scheme of things, or if she should even come out to join us. Tammy waved at her through the glass, gesturing for her to open the door.
This is Abigail, she explained. She's staying with me for a couple days, and this is her first time attending a wedding.
My sister must have briefed everyone ahead of time, because Maggie greeted Abigail with a big hug, and I cringed when their heads touched. I wanted to warn my daughter not to get too close.
Thank goodness you're here, Maggie said. We have a really big problem, Abigail, and you're the only one who can help us.
The little girl blinked.
Me? Aiden's cousin was supposed to be my flower girl, but she's got strep throat, and she can't make it. But you're the same size, and I bet you'd fit into her dress. If you're willing to step up, you'd be doing all of us a huge favor.
Abigail's mouth hung open, revealing the pointy tips of her little yellow fangs.
You want me to be in your bridal party? I promise, it's super easy. Maggie said. All you have to do is precede the bride down the aisle and scatter flower petals on the runner, she said. I already know. I have a whole book about it. So that's a yes?
Abigail glanced to Tammy for permission, and my sister flashed her a thumbs up.
Yes, I'll do a great job. I'll go get the instructions.
She dove into the Jeep to look for her book, and I leaned closer to my daughter. You don't have to do this, Maggie. I know you're trying to be nice, but it's your special day. You shouldn't have to compromise.
I'm not compromising, Maggie said. I want to do something nice for her.
Aiden didn't say anything. I couldn't tell if he was uncomfortable with the idea or simply uncomfortable with the presence of our family. Abigail's in foster care, I told him. Just to be completely clear, I had no idea she was coming. Tammy just sprang her on me this morning.
Maggie told me. It's fine.
But he didn't seem fine. He seemed annoyed, like we were some unwanted chore he'd been assigned to tackle. Abigail emerged from the Jeep with her etiquette book and thumbed the pages until she found the chapter for flower girls. Maggie was happy to review it with her while the rest of us stood around and watched. Then a tiny electric golf cart came whirring up a paved walkway, like a moon buggy from an old science fiction movie. There were two men in the front seat, and Aiden explained they had come for our things. I said, "Oh, that's not necessary." But it was too late. One man was already taking our bags out of the hatch, while the other covered the driver's seat in a shroud of plastic wrap so he wouldn't soil the interior with his body.
Mr. Zatowski, could I trouble you for the keys?
I didn't like the idea of turning them over, but everyone acted like it was a perfectly normal thing to do, and after the incident with the privacy dock, I didn't want to kick up another fuss. How do I get my car back? The man laughed, like I had made a joke. I guessed someone would just tell me later. After they drove off, I assumed we would go directly inside Osprey Lodge to meet Mr. and Mrs. Gardner. Instead, Aiden led us to a flagstone walkway that wrapped around the side of the building.
We'll take the scenic route to your cottage. Lunch will be waiting when we get there.
I asked if his parents were joining us, and Maggie said no. She explained that Errol was on a Zoom with Capacity's board of directors because they were about to issue their second quarter earnings report. But she didn't mention Catherine Gardner, so I asked Aiden directly.
What about your mother?
How's she feeling?
Not so great, he admitted. The stress is doing a real number on her, Maggie said. And it's exacerbating all of her usual symptoms. The dizziness, neck pain, back pain.
I didn't know much about migraines, but my sister nodded like these were all typical concerns.
I'll tell you something, Maggie. If I had 300 people coming to my house for my child's wedding, the stress would cripple me. I'd be a useless puddle of goo.
She should be better by dinner, Aiden said. She's really excited to meet you, Frank. He bounded ahead and I stepped faster to match his pace and stay beside him. After our awkward first dinner and 3 months of failed meetups, I was ready for a fresh start. I didn't expect to become a second father to the kid, but I hoped he would consider me an ally, a dependable person standing in his corner and cheering him on. How are you feeling, Aiden? I asked. Are you nervous?
I'm fine, he said, with a tone that suggested he wasn't fine but didn't want to talk about it. Thanks for asking.
Every window on the side of the lodge had its curtains drawn, concealing the activity within. We moved through a small copse of pine trees, and I could hear the distant hum of an outboard motor. I smelled fresh-cut grass and the pleasant, earthy musk of fresh water. And then the trail emerged from the trees, and there was Lake Wyndham in all its glory, the sort of majestic view I'd only ever seen on postcards.
Oh my goodness, Tammy exclaimed. Look at it.
We'd arrived at the top of a wide and immaculately landscaped lawn. The soft grass descended a gently sloping hill before ending at a sandy beach, an L-shaped wooden dock, and a boathouse. And then the lake itself. 10 square miles of royal blue water, speckled with colorful kayaks and sailboats. Completing the view was a horizon with 3 green mountains and a sky full of cotton puff clouds.
This is where Aiden proposed, Maggie explained. Back on Valentine's Day, so the lake was still frozen over. Snow everywhere you looked. Just this beautiful, majestic winter wonderland. I thought we were going snowshoeing, but next thing you know, he was down on one knee with a ring. So romantic, Tammy said. I can't think of a more perfect spot for a proposal.
Aiden smiled through pursed lips, and I realized it was the same beach I'd seen in the photograph. The same beach where he'd posed for a snapshot with Dawn Taggart.
And come Saturday, after the ceremony, this is where we'll have our reception, Maggie continued. Our photographers love it because the golden hour light is incredible.
There were large wooded areas on both sides of the lawn. Dense New England forests crisscrossed with paved trails and smaller dirt paths, and Maggie warned that it was easy to get disoriented in the woods, especially at night. I showed her the map we'd received from Hujo, and she seemed skeptical.
That's not going to help when it's after midnight and you can't see your hand in front of your face. My advice is to always carry your phone, so you'll always have a flashlight.
With my sister's permission, Abigail ran ahead to the beach, and we all followed after her. The sand was soft and white and powdery. Aiden claimed it was imported from Waikiki, but I couldn't tell if he was joking, and I didn't push to clarify. At the moment, no one was swimming or sunbathing, but there were 2 dozen empty lounge chairs and umbrellas, suggesting that many more guests were expected. Abigail stopped at a small fleet of kayaks, canoes, and sailboats.
Mr. Frank, do you want to go canoeing?
We just got here, I reminded her.
Maybe after lunch, Tammy suggested.
At the edge of the beach was another flagstone walkway, and this one followed the edge of the shore past the boathouse and around the lake. After a minute of walking, we arrived at a 2-story cottage made of steel and glass and stone, with a wide wraparound porch and big windows overlooking the lake.
This is Blackbird, Maggie announced. I think it's the cutest property at the camp, and I wanted you guys to have it.
Aiden explained that every building on the property had keyless locks, so we would use Bluetooth technology to enter our cabin. Tammy and I surrendered our phones so Aiden could download and install the necessary app. The camp had lightning-fast Wi-Fi, and the process took less than a minute. I'm adding you to our family account, he explained, so you can access all the main buildings. Now, walk to your door and watch what happens. As I climbed the steps to the front porch, the door clicked open and swung inward, as if released by a spring. I stepped inside a great room with hard pine floors, rough-hewn timber walls, and a stone fireplace that rose through a two-story atrium. The place was furnished with rustic decorations, elk antlers and vintage wooden oars and maps of the local terrain, plus enough chairs and sofas for a dozen visitors. How many people are staying here?
Just you three.
Aiden pointed to the upstairs balcony and a pair of doors. Your luggage should be waiting in the bedrooms. You're in the master suite, on the left, but Tammy's room is almost identical. I think you'll both be very pleased. My sister and Abigail followed us inside, and Tammy clutched a hand over her heart.
Holy guacamole! Look at this place! Abigail, have you ever seen anything like it?
The kids spun around in a circle and pretended to faint on the floor.
Are you serious? This is our motel room?
Feel free to use anything in the house, Maggie said. And if you need something you can't find, just pick up the phone and dial 0. Someone will run it right over.
I felt certain the cottage had everything we could possibly want. There were closets filled with extra blankets, pillows, towels, first aid kits, bug sprays, flashlights, and pullover water shoes, plus an enormous flat-screen TV with dual soundbars, a big round table for playing cards, and a whole shelf full of board games, mouse traps, snakes and ladders, trouble, and taboo. But my delight was short-lived because Aiden announced he was already leaving.
Glenn's here, he told Maggie, and he showed her a text on his phone. I better go lend a hand.
Of course.
She gave him a quick peck on the cheek.
Say hi for me, and we'll see you at dinner.
Aiden encouraged us to unpack and relax and enjoy ourselves, and then, just like that, he was gone. We'd been at the camp for a total of 18 minutes. Where's he going? I asked.
College friend, Maggie
said, as if this explained everything, as if I hadn't just driven 360 miles to have lunch with my future son-in-law. Tammy must have heard the irritation in my voice because she changed the subject.
Do I smell cinnamon rolls, or is it just my imagination? I'll show you, Maggie said.
She walked us through a dining area and into a thoroughly modern kitchen. Waiting on the countertop was an enormous spread of food, baskets of fresh-baked bread, platters of miniature sandwiches, a whole tray of fresh-cut fruit, and a mountain of pastries and cookies and brownie bites. There were enough provisions to last the three of us all weekend, but Maggie presented the vast buffet as simply lunch.
I figured you'd want something quick, she said. Does this look okay?
Tammy laughed.
Maggie, are you kidding? This is more than we have for Thanksgiving.
Abigail asked for permission to start, then reached for a plate and started loading it up with chicken sliders, miniature BLTs, and 3 enormous scoops of potato salad. Take it easy, I told her. The food's not going anywhere.
She's just hungry, Tammy said. I'm hungry too.
Then she passed me a plate and grabbed one for herself.
Go ahead and eat, Maggie said. I'll give you some time to settle in, and then I'll swing back in a couple hours.
I couldn't believe it. A couple hours?
Dad, I have wedding stuff.
I thought we were having lunch together.
No, I said there would be lunch for you, but I ate before you got here, because I still have a million things to do.
I returned my plate to the counter. Then let me help you, kiddo. Put me to work. What needs to be done? She shook her head, like I was failing to grasp the enormous magnitude of planning a wedding.
Dad, we have 300 people coming this weekend. 60 are vegetarian, 26 are vegan, 11 are gluten-free. There's 100 guests staying at the camp, and another 200 staying in hotels, and I need 3 very nice charter buses to shuttle people back and forth.
The pitch of her voice climbed higher and higher because she wasn't stopping to breathe.
However, the only charter bus company within 100 miles just canceled on me for no reason at all. No apology, no explanation, just, sorry, miss, we can't make it. So, unless you know 3 bus drivers, I don't think you can help me.
I actually did know 3 bus drivers. It's a popular second career for UPS drivers who get tired of hauling boxes. But none of them owned their own vehicles, and they certainly didn't drive the kind of luxury bus that the gardeners probably wanted.
Oh, sweetie, that's terrible, Tammy said. Did you call the Better Business Bureau? It's their job to investigate these companies. Someone has to hold them accountable.
Maggie nodded patiently and waited for my sister to finish her suggestion.
That's a great idea, Aunt Tammy, but I already have a plan. I just need to go do it. If you all want to help me, you'll just stay here and unpack and relax.
I could see she was frazzled. I knew planning a wedding was a ton of work, and I didn't want to add to my daughter's growing list of burdens. So I tried to look agreeable, but she could still see the disappointment on my face.
Listen, Dad, I'll try to be back by 3 o'clock, and then I'll give you a tour of the camp, okay? How does that sound?
That sounds great, Tammy said, hooking her elbow through mine and then leading me away from my daughter.
Go take care of business, Maggie. We'll be fine. Don't you worry.
6. Abigail ate too much and threw up. I saw it coming from a mile away. It must have been her first time eating from a buffet. She seemed to think she was required to try everything. I said,
"Hey, Cookie Monster, take it easy."
And my sister got upset with me.
"Don't say that, Frankie."
"Why not? Look at her."
Abigail had actual cookie crumbs all down the front of her shirt, and now she was eating fruit salad faster than she could swallow it. Her cheeks were stuffed with green grapes she hadn't gotten to yet, and still she kept pushing more in.
She's had issues with food insecurity.
"You're going to choke, Abigail. Slow down."
"Don't regulate her. That's not what you do."
"She looks like a hamster. I don't want her eating like this in front of the gardeners."
"I'll take care of it. Just eat your lunch. Everything's going to be fine."
Then Abigail bolted for the bathroom and fell in front of the toilet, yakking her guts out. I reached for a handful of cherry tomatoes and popped one into my mouth.
"What a shocker," I said. "Who could have seen that coming?"
Tammy frowned.
"You promised you would be cool with this, and instead you're being a jerk. I don't know why you're so irritable, but it needs to stop."
She went to help Abigail and left me alone to finish my lunch. I knew she was correct. I was being a jerk, and I didn't know why I felt so irritable. Maybe it was my lack of sleep, or maybe I just knew from the get-go that something about the camp was wrong. So, yeah, lunch was pretty much a bust, but our moods improved tremendously after we all went upstairs to unpack. Holy Mother of God, you would not believe the size of my master suite. I could run laps around the place for exercise. There was a king-size bed, my own private bathroom, another enormous flat screen with Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, Apple, the works, and a little balcony just for me, so I could sit outside with a beer and watch the sun go down over Lake Wyndham. Tammy was next door in a suite identical to mine, and Abigail was at the end of the hall in a tiny room for children with a nautical theme. There were colorful fish swimming all over the wallpaper and miniature bunk beds painted to look like sailboats. Abigail couldn't believe she had her choice of the upper bunk or the lower bunk. I think she'd been expecting to sleep on the floor. Unpacking my suitcase only took a minute, and then I changed my clothes so I wouldn't look like a landscaper anymore. My suite had a small writing desk facing the window, and someone had left me a calendar of events. Margaret and Aiden's wedding weekend, Thursday, July 21st, 12 to 5 p.m. Unpack, unwind, relax, and explore. 5 p.m., welcome cocktails, main lawn. 6 p.m., dinner, main lawn. 8 p.m., campfire s'mores, beach. Friday, July 22nd, 11 a.m., group hike to Cormorant Point. 12 p.m., lunch at Cormorant Point. 4 p.m., rehearsal, the Globe. 6 p.m., rehearsal dinner, main lawn. 8 p.m., karaoke contest, beach. Saturday, July 23rd, 11 a.m., outdoor brunch, main lawn. 3 p.m., wedding, the Globe. 4 p.m., post-nuptial cocktails, main lawn. 5 p.m. to whenever. Dinner, dancing, and more dancing, main lawn. The schedule was encouraging me to unwind, relax, and explore, but I was far too anxious to nap or lounge in a rocking chair, and I didn't feel comfortable wandering the camp on my own. I was nervous about meeting Errol and Catherine Gardner in person, and I guess I wanted Maggie to be present when that first encounter actually happened. So instead, I sat down at the tiny writing desk and worked on my toast. I'd already cut it down to 2 pages, and then I'd spent the last few weeks rewriting them, over and over. I'd try a line, cross it out, and then repeat the same sentiment with different words. Maggie, I am so proud of the woman you've become. Scratch. And Maggie, you have always been such a kind and sweet and generous person. Scratch. And if Maggie's mother is watching us from heaven, I know she's pleased by what she sees. Scratch. I was trying to speak from the heart, but any time I read my words out loud, they just felt cheesy and corny and false, and the more I revised, the worse everything got. I found myself wishing I knew some kind of professional writer who could give me advice, and that's what made me think of Vicky. She wasn't a professional writer, but her son was, and she read more books than anyone else I'd ever known. I dialed the number of her salon, and the receptionist got her on the line.
Frank? She asked. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm sorry to bother you. I wanted to ask you for a favor. I explained my problem with the toast and asked if she'd be willing to read it over and give me some pointers. And of course, I offered to pay her, whatever she felt was fair.
You don't have to pay me. It'd be my pleasure.
She suggested that I text her the toast and promised to get back to me in the morning.
I'm sure it's better than you think. Everybody gets self-conscious about their writing.
I pleaded with her to be straight with me. I reminded her that in 48 hours I needed to stand in front of 300 people and read the whole thing out loud. If it sucks, I need you to be honest.
If it sucks, I promise we'll make it better. Just send it over, and I'll call you tomorrow.
She sounded distracted. She explained that she had a toddler waiting in her chair and described the kid as a ticking time bomb.
If I don't finish her in 5 minutes, she's going to explode.
So I thanked her again and let her get back to work. Then I typed my whole toast into a single text and zapped it off to her. And after that, I felt a whole lot better, because I knew I could count on Vicky to make it right. But there wasn't much time to feel satisfied, because all of a sudden, Abigail was screaming. 7. Loud, terrified shrieks jolted me out of my chair. She sounded like she was being attacked. I opened my door and Tammy was already out of her bedroom. Together, we ran down the hallway to find Abigail. Her door was closed, but we could hear her on the other side, yelling like she'd stepped onto a bear trap. We went inside and found her backed into a corner, eyes wide with terror, gesturing furiously to an empty wall.
"Abby, what is it?" Tammy asked. "What's wrong?"
She was too hysterical to answer. She just kept pointing and shaking her finger at some invisible, unspeakable horror. Tammy approached her cautiously, both hands raised to show she meant no harm.
"It's okay. It's all right. You're safe here. No one's going to hurt you. Breathe, sweetie. Breathe."
Abigail flipped face down on the rug like she was trying to bury her head in the floor. She was inconsolable. She hammered her fists and kicked her feet, and I started to think maybe she had much bigger problems than food insecurity. Maybe she had a major behavioral disorder. Maybe she'd throw a temper tantrum at the wedding and fling all her flower petals into the horrified faces of Aiden's parents. But as I looked around her bedroom in despair, I realized the blank wall wasn't entirely blank. There was a door to a closet, and it was still slightly ajar. I moved closer to investigate, and Abigail shrieked like a tea kettle at a full boil.
"Don't, Mr. Frank, don't!" "Sweetheart, it's okay. We're here," Tammy said.
By this point, she was holding Abigail and smoothing her hair with the palm of her hand.
"What's wrong? What did you see?"
She shook her head, refusing to answer, as if naming her discovery would somehow grow its power. "Oh, for Pete's sake!" I threw open the door to reveal an empty cedar closet. Nothing but a single high shelf, a wooden rod, and a couple of wire coat hangers. As I leaned inside, an overhead light flickered on, revealing a fuzzy clump of something on the shelf. At first glance, I thought it was a wig, a long weave of curly dark brown hair. Then I looked more closely and realized it was quivering, like it had a very faint pulse.
"What is it?"
Tammy asked.
"Frankie, what do you see?"
I grabbed a coat hanger and used one end to gently poke at the wig. A daddy long legs climbed out of it, then another, and then suddenly dozens more. I realized it wasn't a wig, it was a nest, hundreds of daddy long legs huddled together for safety and warmth in the darkness of the closet. Now they were fleeing from attack and scrambling across the walls. A big fat one dropped on my hand, and I shrieked. I couldn't help it. I slapped myself silly trying to knock it off.
"Close the door,"
Abigail screamed. I slammed it shut, then looked down and saw a half-inch gap at the bottom. I yanked a blanket off the bed and used it to seal the openings. "It's spiders," I said. "Daddy Longlegs."
"Daddy Longlegs aren't spiders," Tammy said. "They're totally different animals."
I told her I didn't care. In my book, if a bug has 8 legs and looks like a spider, then it's a spider. They must have laid eggs. At the mention of eggs, Abigail yowled, and I begged her to please, please stop screaming. "You've already got eggs in your hair, so let's not overreact." She fell onto her side and hugged her knees, curling herself into a ball while my sister frowned.
"That's not helpful."
"I'm sorry, but I can't think with her screaming. Can you please find some way to shut her up?" Tammy rubbed her hand in gentle circles on Abigail's back, trying to soothe her.
"Let's just call the gardeners and explain the problem. I'm sure we can switch cottages."
"No, I'm not doing that."
"Why not?"
"Because it sounds pathetic. What kind of man calls Errol Gardner and complains about spiders in his closet?"
It's a serious infestation, Frankie. I think they need to call an exterminator.
Those guys are a waste of money. They charge you $300 to spray a bunch of poison, but all I need's a good shoe. Tammy and Abigail waited outside on the front porch, while I did all my dirty work with a Florsheim leather Oxford, one half of the pair I'd brought to walk Maggie down the aisle. I didn't want the spiders to escape, so I sealed myself in the closet and started swatting. It was brutal, nasty work. There were hundreds of spiders, and their mashed-up bodies excreted a foul odor, like something you'd squeeze from a boil. But I soldiered on, gagging on the awful stench, until every last one was dead. Then I went downstairs for a bowl of warm water and a kitchen sponge, and I proceeded to wipe down the cedar walls and ceiling, cleaning up all the broken legs and splattered remains. So much for unpack, unwind, relax, and explore. After I finished, I went outside to the front of the cottage and told Tammy the coast was clear. Then we spent a good 10 minutes persuading Abigail that it was safe to return indoors. She was certain that I'd missed a few spiders and said she'd rather spend the weekend sleeping on the porch. I reminded her that most bugs lived outdoors, that the forest was alive with beetles, ticks, wasps, and centipedes, but this just set her off all over again.
"I won't go back in there," Abigail said. "I can't do it, Miss Tammy. Please don't make me do it. Please, 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 please."
So I figured, fine, case closed. Let the kids sleep on the porch. There were some really nice Adirondack chairs, and we'd just bury her in blankets or dial 0 on the house phone to request a sleeping bag. But my sister said she had a better idea, and she asked me to come inside the cottage.
"I want to talk to you for a minute."
We went into the kitchen, and Tammy used the little Nescafe machine to fix us both coffee. She made mine with milk and 2 sugars because she knows that's how I take it. Then she placed the tiny cup in front of me and lowered the boom.
"I think you and Abigail should switch rooms."
"No way! Forget it!
It's just a place to sleep. We're going to spend most of the weekend outside."
"Fine. You give her your room."
"I can't trade with her, Frankie. You know I'm scared of bugs."
"The bugs are gone." I was still holding the Florsheim shoe, and I showed her the bottom. "I just killed 1,000 of them. I was like John Wick in there."
"Right, but you couldn't have gotten all of them. There are more spiders in that room, I'm sure of it. And if we force Abigail to stay there, she'll be up half the night screaming. We won't get a wink of sleep."
I was struck by the maddening realization that Tammy was right. I had to choose between a sleepless night in my luxury suite or a solid 8 hours in a child's bunk bed. "This is why I didn't want to bring her. I told you there'd be trouble." I pointed upstairs to the second floor. "That is nicer than any hotel room I've ever seen, and I shouldn't have to give it up."
"Don't blame this on me, Frankie. I wanted to call the gardeners and ask for a new cottage, but you said you'd take care of it yourself, and then all you did was chase those spiders back into their hidey holes. How is this my fault?"
Out on the porch, Abigail was pacing back and forth in front of a window, furiously scratching her head with both hands. "Please, Tammy. She wants to sleep outside."
"Frankie, that poor girl spent all of March and April sleeping outside. She and her mother were living behind a Taco Bell. There is no way I'm making her do that again. I want her in a proper bed with clean sheets and a pillow, just like me and you and the gardeners. Do you understand?"
All I understood was that I'd already lost the argument. Again. So I threw my goddamn cup in the goddamn sink and then went upstairs to move my stuff. 8. My new bedroom had nowhere to sit. apart from a tiny story corner furnished with plump pillows and colorful picture books. I unpacked my things as quickly as possible, then went down to the kitchen and sat alone at the buffet. All the downtime was driving me crazy. I wanted to walk outdoors and see the entire camp. I wanted to go swimming and hiking and canoeing, and more than anything, I wanted to meet my future in-laws. I think that's the real reason I felt so irritable. I couldn't believe that Errol and Catherine still hadn't come over to welcome us. I was upset that Aiden had immediately bolted to spend time with his college buddy, and then Maggie rushed off into town and wouldn't even let me come with her. I tried to remind myself that she was very busy, and sometimes the best way to help a person is to just get out of their way. But I already had the uneasy feeling that we were unwelcome, that we'd only been invited due to a sense of obligation. At 3 o'clock, I went outside to wait for my daughter. Abigail was sitting in a porch rocker and leaning over a checkerboard, playing a game against herself.
"Thanks for switching rooms, Mr. Frank."
"It's fine." She tapped the checkerboard.
"Do you want to play?"
"I can't. Maggie's going to be here any minute."
"Where are you going?"
"She wants to show me the camp."
"Can I come?"
"Well, it's not going to be very interesting. We're just going to look at the buildings and, talk about the history of the place." She stood up anyway.
"That's okay."
"Well, and the other thing is, Maggie wants to spend a little one-on-one time with me, because we don't see much of each other." Abigail just stared at me, still not grasping the point, and I realized I had to spell it out for her. "It's better if you just stay here." She sank back into her chair.
"All right."
"What's Tammy doing?"
"She's taking a bubble bath. They didn't have bubbles in her bathroom, but she dialed 0 on the house phone, and a lady brought some right over. 3 different scent options."
"Go tell her you're bored."
"I'm not bored. I just wanted to come with."
Abigail returned her focus to the game and used a red checker to double jump 2 blacks. I looked all around for Maggie, hoping she would materialize and rescue me from the awkwardness of the conversation. But there was still no trace of her, so I stood there and watched Abigail play an imaginary opponent until my phone started ringing. I checked the display. "Maggie, heart, heart, heart," and then answered immediately. "Hey, what's the holdup?"
"Sorry, I'm still here in town."
"What's wrong?"
"Everything," she said,
before firing off a list of the latest disasters. The florist mixed up the table settings, the videographer tested positive for COVID, and she still needed a solution to the bus problem. All her problems seemed to be multiplying. "What about your wedding planner? Isn't she supposed to handle this stuff?"
"It's a team effort, Dad. We're all doing the best we can. I should be back in time for dinner, okay?"
"In time for dinner? You mean 6 o'clock?
"Dad, listen. You don't need me to see the camp. Take the map. Go exploring. Meet some people. There's horseshoes, a game room, a million different activities."
She spoke to me like I was a kid on summer vacation with no friends and nothing to do. She didn't seem to understand that I'd come to New Hampshire to spend time with family, not play horseshoes with a bunch of random strangers. But I could hear the aggravation in her voice, and I didn't want to make things any worse. So I just said, "All right, see you soon," and ended the call. Abigail was still hunched over the checkerboard and pretending that she hadn't been eavesdropping, but I'd been careful not to say anything that would reveal my change of plans. "Heading out now," I told her.
"Where's Maggie?"
"I'm going to meet her at the lodge." She flashed me a thumbs up, and I suddenly felt very silly for lying to a 10-year-old. But I guess I didn't want anyone to know I'd been ditched, Abigail said.
"See you later, Mr. Frank."
And that was the end of it. From our cottage, there were several different trails into the woods, but I just walked back the way we'd arrived, following the shore of Lake Wyndham for a minute or two, until I was back on the beach. All the lounge chairs were still empty, and no one was swimming in the water. But up on the main lawn, closer to Osprey Lodge, men and women in white coats were rolling large tables across the grass and carrying out armfuls of folding chairs. They appeared to be setting up for the reception, even though it was only Thursday. I saw a carpenter in a Dartmouth sweatshirt firing a nail gun into a lumber frame. He was constructing a large platform, a kind of elevated stage, and I asked if he needed help. I suppose I was still looking for some way to contribute. He gave me a sideways look and asked, "You work here?" I explained that I was Maggie's father, in town for the wedding, and he immediately straightened and set down his nail gun. "That's okay, Mr. Zatowski. You should just relax and enjoy the camp." Why was everyone telling me to relax and enjoy the camp? "I'm surprised you're setting up so early," I said. "What if it rains before Saturday?" "This isn't for the wedding." He gestured to the big round tables, now draped with white linens and ringed by folding chairs. "All this is for tonight." Up until that moment, I'd expected Thursday's dinner to be an intimate meal with just my family and the gardeners. But the caterers were setting out glasses and silverware for dozens of people. It might not have been the actual wedding, but it was already far more extravagant than any wedding I'd ever seen. The carpenter returned to his work and fired a long line of nails into the platform. And as I stood there, deliberating my next move, Aiden emerged from the back of the lodge, accompanied by a woman with long red hair. I waved and called his name, but with the nail gun blasting, he didn't hear me. He and the woman set off on a narrow trail that disappeared into the trees. I hurried across the lawn, weaving around tables and caterers trying to catch up. By the time I reached the start of the trail, they had already vanished into the woods. But since everybody kept encouraging me to explore the camp, I decided to follow the path anyway. Inside the woods, it was cooler and darker and surprisingly quiet. The sounds of the camp fell away, and soon I heard nothing but trilling cicadas and the occasional bird song. From time to time, I'd glance at the paper map and try to orient myself, but the trail wasn't marked. I was west of Osprey Lodge in a large cluster of trees labeled Imagination Grove, and the path was leading me to the outermost boundaries of the property. I began to understand that the map couldn't possibly be drawn to scale, that the wooded grove must have been much larger than shown, so all the areas would fit on a single page. Or maybe I was just lost. One of the most useful things I learned during my 4 years in the United States Army is a concept known as situational awareness. The idea is that you're always assessing your surroundings with a focus on threats, risks, and signs of recent disturbances. A very useful mindset for a scared 19-year-old kid patrolling Iraqi villages during the 1991 Gulf War, and I've found the habits hard to shake. To this day, I can't walk into a restaurant without taking note of the emergency exits. After several minutes of following the trail, I stopped and turned around, and I did not see a single living creature. There was no reason for me to feel nervous in an open wooded area with clear sight lines in every direction, but I had the uneasy feeling that an ambush was waiting just around the corner, that I was walking into some kind of trap. The path brought me up a steep section of trail that was poorly maintained, and then I glimpsed a structure in the distance, something resembling an old tool shed and completely unlike all the modern buildings back at the camp. This one had worn-out wooden siding, dusty windows, and a gray shingled roof speckled with spongy green moss. I checked the map to orient myself, but the building wasn't on it. I approached from the side, a flat and mostly featureless wall with two rusty vents and a single hung window. The curtains were drawn, but the screen was open, and I could hear voices within. One belonged to Aiden, but the other person, the woman, was doing most of the talking. I couldn't discern all of her words, just the general tenor of the conversation. She was angry, and Aiden was placating her, or trying to.
"This isn't fair."
"I know.
It's not fair to me."
"I hear you. I understand."
"Don't say you understand, Aiden, because if you really understood, if you actually agreed with me, you wouldn't be doing this."
He said something I couldn't make out, and I dared to move even closer, stepping softly across dry leaves until I was right beside the window. Then he said, "What would you like me to do?"
"Tell the truth."
"Besides that,
I'll help you. I still care about you. We can do it together."
"No, no, no. We are not doing anything. There is no we." And then he said something I couldn't make out again. The woman was upset, but Aiden's tone was steady, stubborn, immutable. I glanced around, afraid that someone might catch me eavesdropping. But from what I could gather, the three of us were all alone in the forest. I sidestepped to the back of the cabin, to a larger window where their voices were easier to hear.
"You're not seeing the big picture. Maybe I should talk to Margaret."
"Do not talk to Margaret.
I just think—"
"Stay the fuck away from Margaret."
"Jesus. Aiden—"
"She cannot know about this conversation. If you say one word to her—" The rest of the sentence was spoken under his breath.
"Are you threatening me?"
"No, I just—"
"Are you sure? Because that sounded like a threat."
"Relax, okay? Come here." Hanging over the back window were faded yellow curtains that didn't quite reach the sill. I pressed my face to the screen and squinted through the open gap. I saw a cluttered room, dimly lit, canvases leaned against the walls and stacks that were 6 or 7 deep. There was a workbench full of paints and supplies and a large wooden easel. Aiden stood with his back to me, and the woman was embracing him. She was my daughter's age, tall, with long red hair and a freckled complexion, and we immediately locked eyes. She straightened her shoulders and shook off Aiden's hands.
"Someone's here," she said.
The sun was at my back. I realized I had cast a shadow on the curtains. Aiden spun around, and I leaped away from the window. He walked over and peered outside.
"Frank? What are you doing here?"
I gave the first explanation that came to mind. "Just exploring the camp." Then I showed him the paper map, hoping it would add some credibility to my story. "It seems like I got myself lost."
"You're not lost. This is my studio. Come around to the front, and I'll give you a tour."
Aiden was waiting in the doorway when I reached the entrance.
"You've found my little secret. I've tried painting back at the lodge, but it's impossible. Too many distractions. All the staff coming and going. But this place is perfect. It's the last surviving structure from the original summer camp. Super quiet, and you won't find it on any of the maps. Most people don't even know it's here."
I followed him inside. The air was musty and smelled of chemicals, mineral spirits, turpentine, linseed oil. There were paintings everywhere, lots of haunted black and white faces, like the ones in his penthouse apartment. But many more were incomplete or abandoned, and these canvases showed just pieces of faces. An open mouth, a long, slender neck, a single ear, half concealed by lengths of hair. I found these face parts even more unsettling than the completed portraits. The redhead was leaning against Aiden's workbench. She wore a cream-colored blouse, a long green skirt, and brown leather sandals. All her clothes and jewelry looked homemade and slightly primitive, like she'd come from a Renaissance fair.
"Frank, this is Gwendolyn,"
Aiden said. And I realized I'd misheard him earlier. He'd been running off to meet Gwen, not Glenn. We went to art school together. Now she's a teacher, like me. She seemed amused by the comparison. Aiden likes to make people sound important. I teach at a preschool on Tuesdays, finger paints and popsicle sticks. The rest of the week, I'm just driving for DoorDash.
That's nothing to be ashamed of, I told her. I've been at UPS for 26 years.
Driving?
It's hard work, but I guarantee we pay better than DoorDash. She seemed genuinely intrigued, so I bragged a little about my union benefits, about the pension plan and the health care and the perks of being a Teamster. Plus, they're dying to hire more women right now, because of Me Too and everything. Depending on your location, you could have a real good shot.
You know, I might just look into it, she said. How do you guys know each other?
Frank is Margaret's father, Aiden explained. And it was like he'd flipped a switch. All at once, her entire demeanor soured.
Wait, you're Margaret's father?
Yes, Frank Zatowski.
Then I guess you'll be hanging up the brown uniform pretty soon, right? Have you delivered your last package?
She wasn't the first person to make this kind of joke. A lot of my friends at work had made similar comments. Like they all expected Maggie to turn over some vast sum of money that would allow me to move to Key West and vacation in Hawaii and live a life of leisure with all my new gardener relations. But I had no intention of taking a penny from my daughter. I've always felt that family fortunes should only travel in one direction. Downhill, from parent to child, and not the other way around.
I'm pretty happy with my life, I told her. I'm not making any changes.
She didn't try to hide her skepticism or her sudden inexplicable contempt for me.
And is Aiden going to call you Dad, or do you think you'll keep things on a first-name basis?
We haven't talked about it, I turned to Aiden. But since Gwen brought it up, I'm happy to answer to either one, whatever makes you more comfortable.
I know, Frank, and thank you. Gwen's just being provocative. It's kind of her brand.
She snorted at the assessment.
Sure, Aiden. Telling the truth is so edgy. I'm a real loose cannon.
Then she leaned closer to me, squinting at my wristwatch.
Tell me something, Frank. What time do you have?
3:30.
She shot a wry look at Aiden, as if this proved some kind of point.
All right. I'm going to go jump off a cliff. But it was great to meet you, Frank. I'm sure you'll have an amazing weekend. Give my best to Margaret.
Then she went out the door and bounded off into the woods. And maybe I was imagining it, but I thought she put some extra swing in her hips, like she knew we were watching.
Sorry about that, Aiden said.
Did I say something to offend her?
It's nothing you did. She's just weird about money.
He explained that Gwendolyn lost her parents at the age of 7, so she'd been raised by her grandmother, an Irish immigrant who worked as a housekeeper. Somehow, Gwendolyn managed to attend NYU Steinhardt on a full scholarship, where she and Aiden struck up an unlikely friendship. They were close friends and confidants for 4 years, then parted ways after graduation. Aiden moved to his penthouse apartment in Boston, and Gwendolyn went back to Lawrence, Massachusetts, and her 81-year-old grandmother. Because the world wasn't fair, Aiden said, and making a living as a visual artist was just about impossible.
What does that have to do with me?
It's got nothing to do with you. She's just weird whenever she's here. Very critical of the camp. And she hates capacity. It was probably a mistake to invite her, but we used to be good friends.
I wanted to ask about the conversation I'd overheard, but there was no way to do it without admitting I'd been eavesdropping.
This isn't fair. Tell the truth. Maybe I should talk to Margaret.
I reminded myself that I hadn't heard the entire conversation, so they could have been talking about anything. But still,
are you threatening me?
He was waiting for me to say something, waiting to see if I'd make another move in this weird game we were playing. But I needed time to process everything I'd learned. I looked around the studio and noticed a metal spiral staircase in the far corner, descending through a hole in the floor. Where does that go?
To the fallout shelter.
Seriously? He nodded.
This camp was built in 1954, at the height of the Red Scare, back when the government was subsidizing bomb shelters, and everybody was building them.
He was interrupted by a chirping from his pocket. Aiden reached for his phone and checked the screen.
It's my dad. I better take this.
He turned away from me, seeking some small measure of privacy, and I studied the spiral staircase. Narrow steps of grated metal wrapped around and around a black steel pole before vanishing into the darkness. It was like staring down into a well.
Yeah, I'm actually with him right now. We're at my studio.
Aiden listened for a moment before turning to me.
Dad wants to know if you're free for a drink.
Of course. Aiden said we'd be right over and then ended the call. As we exited the studio, he pulled the door shut, and I noticed it was fitted with another Bluetooth lock. Aiden said his father was waiting for us in Osprey Lodge, and I invited him to lead the way. But instead, he turned in the direction of the lake.
Just one other thing, Frank. Margaret mentioned you received something in the mail, some kind of photograph.
Right. It's in my suitcase. He forced an awkward smile, apologizing for putting me out.
Do you think we could grab it on the way? My dad really wants to see it.